Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Jared Hooker Moyna was a prolific Republican gunman. He's been linked to several murders, including that of Shankill butcher Lenny Murphy.
The paramilitary leader had known he was a marked man ever since he was released from a jail sentence for arms offences 3 months ago. The IRA say their Belfast brigade did it. They'd executed Murphy because he'd been involved in at least 20 murders involving nationalists and a number of Protestants.
He was also believed to be involved in the killing of solicitor and unionist politician Edgar Graham.
Edgar Graham was a law lecturer at Queen's University. He was gunned down as he walked to work just a few yards from the law faculty. Two IRA gunmen posing as students had been waiting behind a low wall.
As well as IPLO spokesman Jimmy Brown.
According to the security forces, he was sitting in this Gold Orion car in West Belfast when a lone gunman approached and fired a number of shots at point-blank range.
The former IRA, INLA, IPLO and even Continuity IRA man has died, aged 69. Shots were fired over his coffin the night before his funeral on the 4th of April.
He's a man who just needed to be at the centre of everything. He wasn't made for ceasefire times and for peaceful living. You know, he was made for that high adrenaline, armed conflict world.
To tell us more about Hooker Moyna, I'm joined by the Belfast Telegraph security correspondent, Alison Morris. Alison, you're very welcome to the Bell Tale.
Thanks for having me.
Shots fired over a coffin. Can we start with that? Who fired them? We don't see that overly often now.
No, and if you watch the video, which is on the Bell Tale's website, you will see that you can see, actually, just looking at that video, there are three quite youngish-looking men, albeit with masks up and hoods up. You can see they're not people of a certain vintage, and they're not wearing a paramilitary uniform as such. They've trainers on, jeans up, and just the hoods up, and masks on. The three of them walk out behind a coffin, which has been placed on the street. It looks to me very like to be Bombay Street, which is where Jared Hooker Moyna lived his entire life. And it's draped in a tricolour, and one of them fires three shots over the top of the coffin. There's a huge picture of Hooker Moyna in front of that coffin as well. And that would be something, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many times I've reported on that, that shots are fired over the top of coffins. Jared Hooker Moyna had been a member of numerous organisations, so if you would ask me who was responsible, it'd be like a take your pick. I would probably take a guess that it was people who would be not particularly linked very strongly to any one group or another, and who had agreed, potentially prior to his death, that they would do this tribute to him after his death. Many of those old Republicans, they want the proper, what they call a guard of honour, they want the volley of shots. But obviously, given the fact that we have moved on and it's only dissidents who can do those, they often then ask for favours before they die, say, if I go, will you make sure that this happens or that happens? And so I would speculate that it was people on the fringes of those dissident Republican groups. But given how many organisations Hooker Moyna had dalliances with over the years, as I'm hearing, it's just what they would call, I suppose, and I'm not going to call them independent Republicans or dissident Republicans, but people who agreed to do it because they knew him personally rather than an organisation doing it because he was their member.
Who was he?
Gerard Hooker Moynagh had been a member of the IRA's C Company, that sort of Clonard-based part of the IRA. That's where he was from. He was from Bombay Street. Bombay Street, obviously most famous for, in 1969, being one of the streets that was subject to the burning of Bombay Street. People had to move out. They were refugees. They had to go and live in other parts of Belfast for a time. And then they returned when those houses were built, and he returned and he had lived there. And that's where he died as well. He'd lived there all his life. He became a very, very active and feared IRA member. And most famously, I suppose, during his time in the IRA, he was linked to the murder of Shankill butcher Lenny Murphy. The Shankill butchers obviously need no introduction. This notorious gang of loyalists who would abduct Catholics, just not anyone they targeted, just random. They'd drive through an area where they knew the person that they picked up would be a Catholic, and they would torture them. And then they would kill them and leave their bodies lying in entries, usually somewhere. Lenny Murphy had been one of the leaders of that gang, and he was shot by two IRA men on the Shankill at one stage during an ambush. And we've always been told that I had always been under the impression that one of those gunmen was Gerard Hooker Moynagh, and anyone I've spoke to who was in those circles at that time seems to concur that he was one of the two. He was also linked to the murder of Edgar Graham. He was a unionist and also a solicitor who was shot dead outside of Queen's University. And then he...
And where does that information, where would you, that understanding come from, Alison?
What I could do is I could give you, if you want to give me your email, I could email you a list of my sources, or we could assume that I have went and asked people who would have been involved in the IRA at that time and who would have known him very well at that time. And in order to write about someone, you have to go and speak to as many voices as you possibly can. And it was always of the, you know, understood that Gerard Hooker Moynagh had been involved in that. And he's been linked to a number of other killings as well. But his time with the IRA, while, you know, he would have been, I suppose the term we'd use at the time would have been well got within those IRA circles, he was considered to be slightly out of control. And he had involved himself in a number of operations which weren't sanctioned and which were deemed at that time to be, you know, indiscriminate, solely sectarian in nature. He ended up falling out with the IRA, and he was thrown out of that organisation. But unusually, and this is something that after his death I went and checked with a number of people, usually if you engage in something like that, you would be court-martialed. You'd be court-martialed by, and a lot of people then were sentenced to death or ordered to leave the country or kneecapped or all sorts of other things, and that didn't happen. The only way I could find out why it didn't happen to Hooker Moynagh when he was asked, he was thrown out of the IRA, was that they said that he still had friends and allies in high places. He also had some enemies within the IRA in pretty high places. But he had friends and allies who said that, you know, better just to tell him to jog on. And what somebody else said to me, and they'll use language which I can't use on this podcast, was that he was just too mad to go at. And it's that if you go to take out Hooker Moynagh, you better put him down the first time, because he would come after you and not just kill you, but every member of your family in revenge. And the decision was it was easier just to remove him from the IRA structures and hope that he would fade off into the night, which he did not. Because, you know, if you're someone like him who had been heavily involved, you know, I actually had this discussion with someone too the other day about him, and they had said, you know, he thrived off the adrenaline of that time. He had thrived off being involved in that conflict. He also was someone who had accrued quite a few enemies, so he needed access to weapons. And he also wanted to be in the thick of it, if you like, and therefore he very quickly moved into other organisations. I'm told he had a very brief sort of dalliance with the INLA before joining the IPLO, which was a splinter group of the INLA, a very briefly lived splinter group, probably best known for the killing of the sort of firebrand politician George Seawright. But apart from that, the IPLO was known in West Belfast as a sort of ragtag group of people who were misfits from other organisations, some of whom were heavily involved in criminality. It was a flag of convenience for many of them. And they were involved in a number then of those sectarian shootings, what you would call those sort of like spray jobs in a bar, where they just walked into a bar that they knew was frequented by loyalists and shot the bar up.
I think we need to do a whole podcast on the IPLO, but they did claim to be Marxist-Leninist revolutionaries and the voice of the working class, and yet most of the people they shot were actually Republicans, and they were also involved, as you say, in indiscriminate sectarian murders.
Indiscriminate sectarian murders, and then also they became involved, first of all, you know, in more feuds, and then they start feuding with each other as well. And that is, I suppose, where Hooker Mornay again then came in. What, and I remember this very clearly because, you know, I'm someone from West Belfast and from that time. But the RNLA, I think at that stage, I remember them being linked to allegations that there was a gang rape of a young woman in the Divis area. They were also linked to drugs. And in a lot of that, during that time, the drugs that were coming into Belfast would mainly have been ecstasy. Remember, this is the time of the sort of beginning of the rave culture. And the only way you could have got them was by having some kind of dealings with loyalist paramilitaries as well. So what would become known as the Night of the Long Knives, very theatrical, but basically what it was is the IRA had made a decision that they were going to remove the APLO completely. They had been sent word that they were to disband. They had said no and that they were refusing to do this. And so on the night of October 31st, 1992, the around 60 IRA men took part in what would be known as the Night of the Long Knives, target members of the APLO. There was two masked and armed men walked into Sean Martin's Gilly Club in the Short Strand area of Belfast. They ordered everyone to lie on the floor, and then they singled out a guy, 30-year-old Samuel Ward, who was a member of the APLO, and shot him 10 times. He was obviously a member of that splinter group. There was another member of the APLO with him, and he was left untouched. And the reason he was left untouched, I was told, was to send back word that basically the jig was up. It was time to pack up your tent and go. The person who remained was probably the most feared APLO man at the time. And I don't think there's any mistake that this was the date that the IRA chose to go into action. And that was Gerard Hooker Mornay. Hooker Mornay was in the Crumlin Road prison at the time on remand. He had been stopped, I think it was somewhere over in the Bonmore estate in North Belfast, and it was believed that was on the way to commit a feud-related killing. But he was on remand. So the surviving IPLO man, who we haven't named because he is still alive, he goes to visit Gerard Hooker Mornay in the Crum and said, "What are we going to do? What would you advise me to do?" And I am told that he says to contact the RA, as in the IRA, give them every gun, give them every bullet, give them everything you have and hope that they spare you. And that was his advice. And within a week, the IPLO released a statement saying that it was disbanding.
In November 1992, just over a week after that event, as you said, the IPLO put out a statement bowing down to the IRA's demands for disbandment. To say to carry on under the present circumstances would have been futile and would only serve the interests of Britain. But Moynagh survives that. But can I bring you back? I mean, he did take part in an event which precipitated, which brought that in head. And that is the gunning down of Jimmy Brown, who was a 34-year-old spokesperson for the IPLO.
Yes, and, you know, Jimmy Brown, and I have spoken to numerous people who knew Jimmy Brown very well, he acted as their sort of press spokesperson. We live in times of relative peace, and I suppose people find it bizarre that journalists were dealing with press spokespeople quite openly from paramilitary groups, but they were the times that we were living in then. Jimmy Brown was an unlikely member of the IPLO. As I've said, the IPLO were, I suppose, more identified by being, you know, a ragtag bunch of people who, many of them were expelled from other places, some of whom we're looking the protection of a paramilitary organisation. If you were a member of a Republican, or even to this day a member of a loyalist paramilitary group, another paramilitary group can't target you for, you know, any kind of perceived or alleged misbehaviour without having to first okay that. So there's a sort of no-strike first policy. So there was protection in people who were involved in drug dealing and criminality being a member of the IPLO, because it meant then that they couldn't just be targeted randomly by other organisations. That obviously all went to the wall the night of the Long Knives. Jimmy Brown was the spokesperson. He wouldn't have been someone who would have been, you would imagine, would have been an active member. He was more, I suppose, their strategist. I was told on a few occasions he was out trying to recruit for the organisation. That didn't always go very successfully. But he was well-spoken, he was very educated, he was somebody who you would not have necessarily put within the ranks of the IPLO. But he had been living in Dublin because obviously this feud was ongoing. He had received a call saying, look, we need to end this IPLO feud, we're fighting with each other, something needs to come to a head to stop this. And he travelled to Belfast to take part in those talks. And as he was driving his car, we're told, Hooker Mornay wanted to get out to speak to him. It was Hooker who would have been at the centre of those IPLO peace talks. And instead of, you know, shaking hands and discussing the truce, Hooker Mornay opened fire on him and shot him 10 times. 5 of the bullets hit him in the head, killing him almost instantly.
On the street?
On the street, in front of numerous people in broad daylight.
And the very same day, Hugh McKibben, who was a 21-year-old member of the IPLO, supposedly on their army council, he was gone down the exact same day. Do we understand that that was also, do we also suspect Hukkamoina for that?
I'm not sure whether Hukkamoina was 100% responsible for that, but he would have been responsible in terms of the leadership of that organisation at the time, so nothing would have happened without his say. So I was listening to his funeral, which took place yesterday, and it was painted a very different picture. And I suppose when you know someone, you do know them very differently, but he was someone who was considered, you know, if you did want your dirty work done, if you wanted someone killed and no one particularly wanted to do it, Hukkamoina was your man, which will take you back up, I suppose, to my early days. Well, not early days, I suppose around 2005, 2006. One of Hukkamoina's sons had become involved in criminality. He was involved in quite a infamous hammer attack. It was one of those creeper style burglaries. Him and his brother broke into a house in the middle of the night to steal a car, ended up attacking a man called Morris McCracken with a hammer. And I think it was around 2003, and they were jailed. So Gerard Michael Dunnigan and Kevin Barrymoina, who also was known as Kevin Barry Dunnigan, them two were both jailed for, I think it was for 15 years and 8 years for grievous bodily harm. During that time, there was a tragedy that happened in that family, and one of them was released on compassionate parole to attend a funeral. So Kevin Barrymoina disappeared. Basically, he went AWOL from prison. There was a high profile police campaign to find him, and I'd been writing about this almost daily. So I go out on my lunch one day, and when I come back in, the receptionist said to me, Hukkamoina was in here looking at you. He says he needs to speak to you. Now, I knew Hukkamoina by reputation, at which point my blood went cold. And not only with that, when she added, he said he'll be back. So at which stage I rang someone who would have known Hukkamoina quite well from in around that Clonard area. And I said, Hukkamoina was in work looking at me. Is that bad? And there was a sort of silence on the other end of the phone before he said, oh, that's never good. You need to get someone to sort that out for you. Thankfully, Hukkamoina didn't come back. And I didn't have to face him face to face, so I did never see him again. But yeah, you know, when someone, I told that story to someone after he died, and they says when someone, you know, if someone had told me Hukkamoina was looking at me, I'd have left the country. Never mind, you know, sit there in the vague hope that maybe he would reconsider his actions. But he didn't come back, and I never did find out what it was he wanted me for. I assume it was linked to me writing about his son.
And he ended up, after all of that, I mean, and he's gone through the entire list of Republican paramilitaries, and he ends up in the Continuity IRA.
Yes, which would have been, I suppose, made up at that time of sort of more older, sort of veteran members. It feeds back to what I said about him leaving the IRA and having to join another organisation. This is a man who just needed to be at the centre of everything. You know, he wasn't made for ceasefire times and for peaceful living. You know, he was made for that high adrenaline armed conflict world, which was all he seemed to know and the only place where he seemed to be fully comfortable. And he was involved in a failed bombing attack. A bomb prematurely exploded. And at that stage, we're told he lost a couple of fingers and he damaged his eye quite badly. And that was probably, in terms of his dalliances with violence, the last that I had ever heard of Hukkamoina, apart from the fact when he came into work looking at me and almost sent me into the witness protection scheme. But apart from that, he then seemed to live quite a quiet life, but basically in the same home where he had been raised, you know, in Bombay Street, where he stayed all his life. I know that people would say that, you know, he was still, in terms of his friends, he had still friends in all of those organisations, be it the NLA, the IRA, and all sorts of other veteran ex-prisoners. His funeral, which took place, he did have a tricolour and he had a lone piper walking in front of it. But interestingly, there was no colour party because I don't think he was ever aligned to any one organisation for them to have took on the funeral, because obviously he jumped in and out of so many. I suppose it was a funeral that you would say was a Republican funeral, but it didn't have the visible paramilitary trappings, which had all clearly taken place days before when the shots were fired in, you know, in the dead of night over the top of his coffin. So he's one of those characters that, I suppose, you know, he leaves in his wake a trail of destruction. And then when I was listening into his funeral homily, his family obviously spoke of him very different and said, you know, how about her quiet and polite and opened doors and took his hat off when he entered into rooms and saved stray cats from the street and all sorts of other things. And the priest who was given the homily, obviously it's Easter time, and it was Easter time when he was buried. and told a story that, you know, I thought, my goodness, if ever there was an apt time for a priest to be able to tell that story on the altar, which was basically of Jesus lying on the cross and the thieves on the cross at each side of him and one asking for his forgiveness and him telling him he'd see him in paradise later that night. And I thought, if a priest went through the Bible 100 times, he'd never find a story that would have been more apt to trying to give a homily at the funeral of Hooker Moyna than that one. So that was how he ended. It wasn't a huge funeral. There was several hundred people at it. But and in terms of those big Republican West Belfast funerals, I've seen the whole place come to standstill for them, but it was quite a big funeral. So, you know, in terms of, I suppose, Republicans, I've seen many people who were online calling them all sorts of legends, and then other people saying this guy was a serial killer. And isn't that the strange sort of paradox of our conflict, that when one person looks, when we look back and we see one person, we all judge them in completely different ways. You know, some people will see them as one thing, some people will see them as another. I'll see them as someone who I was very glad I was on my lunch the day that he came into work looking for me. Hooker Moyna was clearly a product of his environment. He was from Bombay Street. We know that the violence that started in Belfast more or less convalesced around that area. Hooker Moyna, who, and I'll not pretend to personally know him, but I do know a lot of people who did know him personally, and I think that Hooker Moyna would be one of them people who would have found a way to become involved in conflict, whether that would have been to go off and be a mercenary in some far off country or something else. I think that he was one of those people who was always going to be involved in violence regardless of what our situation was here, whereas I wouldn't say that for everyone who I've met or come across or whose stories I've covered over the years.
Alison Morris, security correspondent with the Belfast Telegraph, thank you very much.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.